Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, folks. Happy holidays and welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We hope you've enjoyed this month so far of poisoned corsets and frozen ghosts and decapitations as practical jokes on children. We're now going to take you to the distant past, a time called November.
Buckle up, Buttercup. It's the feedback show.
And we are going to start with our episode on Robert Bloch's The Living Dead. On that episode, I was talking about the Grand Guignol, the theater in Paris where the juniper tree would be right at home.
Mark Zimmer writes, I've been obsessed with the idea of the Grand Guignol for years and was surprised to learn recently that the theater has a pretty dark connection with World War II and the Nazis. Though popular for decades, theater attendance dropped off steeply after the war. When it finally closed its doors in 1962, the Grand Guignol's final director, Charles Nonan, is reported to have said, "Before the war, everyone believed that what happened on stage was purely imaginary. Now we know these things, and worse, are possible." Oof. While the horrors of war likely played a part in the theater's declining popularity, the theory leaves out another, arguably darker truth. Despite protests from many of its actors, the Grand Guignol regularly staged performances for German audiences during the Nazi occupation of Paris. There are even accounts of high-ranking Nazi officers personally congratulating cast and crew for their performances in realistic special effects. It's easy to see how everyday Parisians would see the theater's actions during this time as an appeasement of or outright collaboration with their Nazi occupiers.
Wow, that's a hard one to call.
Yeah.
Collaborating or not collaborating is rich territory for drama for that reason, and also comedy. David Halstead wrote, "Funny that you mentioned a Kurt Vonnegut story called To Be or Not to Be in this episode, as there's a 1942 movie of that name involving a troupe of Polish actors working as spies against the Nazis during World War II. It's a screwball comedy starring Carol Lombard and Jack Benny, one of my favorite films."
Hmm.
It's same here, actually. It's a great movie. Unfortunately, Carol Lombard died in a plane crash on a war bond tour in 1942.
Oh.
She's so fantastic, and it would have been great to get more movies from her. But everybody in that film is great. There's a Mel Brooks remake of it.
Yes.
It clearly influenced him. But I would say skip that. Go to the original. That's my film recommendation for the holidays.
Okay.
I feel very strongly, along with David Halstead, that this is a movie that everybody should see.
Sign me up. Steve writes, "We saw Reanimator at the Grand Guignol Resurrection in London a few years ago. Watching a man be chased around the stage by an undead cat was hilarious."
Agreed.
Yeah, sign me up for that too. I want to do it all. Ben Gilbert writes, "I recently watched Five Nights at Freddy's. I can't help but think that they were inspired by your Ghost from the Future podcast from 2015.
I agree. There is so much showbiz pizza / Chuck E. Cheese horror entertainment out there now.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
like a Nicolas Cage movie that's based off of that.
Yep.
And the Five Nights at Freddy's video game is really fun. Eldritch Gollum writes, "Always a fan of a weird war story. Part of the fun, for me anyway, of this subgenre is seeing where fiction ends and reality begins. Because as it turns out, war, for all its mundane horrors and tragedies, can also get pretty weird. Especially within the realm of psychology warfare, or PSYOP, which is essentially what Bloch is describing here. The premise of having an actor dress up as a vampire to scare superstitious townspeople may sound absurd, but it's actually not all that far off from the real strategies our own military has employed on numerous occasions. As historian Robert J. Kudowski writes in his 2007 history of U.S. PSYOP, American psychological operations has unleashed spectral foxes in Japan,
whoa,
vampires in the Philippines, forest demons in Vietnam, and supernatural tanks in the Middle East."
What?
You can check the comment for sources. Which he added for that stuff. "The Nazis also employed psychological warfare, but they didn't use vampires, they used werewolves. As werewolves were seen as positive figures from German folklore, while vampires were associated with Slavs and Jews, the anti-Semitic myth of the blood libel."
All right.
In his book, Hitler's Monsters, historian Eric Kurlander describes how Hitler and Himmler formed a special unit of soldiers called Werewolf, 1E, that was to engage in guerrilla warfare and terrorist actions behind enemy lines. Hitler envisioned this unit as a group of modern-day berserkers, men who would go completely feral when facing their enemy. To aid in this illusion that they were real werewolves, Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels created a pirate radio station called Radio Werewolf, which would broadcast wolf howls throughout towns where the werewolves were supposed to strike, and then play werewolf-themed music with lyrics that would come straight out of a Rob Zombie or Pitch Black Manor song.
What
are you talking about? Like, there'd be songs that would warn them of the coming werewolf soldiers?
Werewolves, they're coming and gonna get you. Ooh. Like, that kind of stuff.
See, that song sounded awesome. Speaking of collaboration, I'm just wondering how that would go down, like, within the band. if the Nazis wanted to play our music to warn people about werewolves. Because on the one hand, you're doing something for the Nazis, but I'm sure Bentley would be like, yeah, but that's a lot of townspeople that are going to hear our music. What if they like it instead of get scared? Could really increase the... Notice how I made Josh the advocate for
doing
it. Not me.
Christopher R. Adams writes, strange how this Halloween episode is your exact 666th regular show episode. Congrats, and I hope to hear 666 more.
That's awesome. We didn't realize that.
I didn't even think about it, of course. Mark Saunders writes, love this story. The ending genuinely surprised me. Maybe it's because I'm so used to Block's earlier supernatural works, but I kept expecting the real vampire count to come back and get his revenge on the Nazis, so that the real ending was a total shock, and I loved it.
Michelle Albert agrees. She wrote, I would say that this is a strange story, mostly because I expected for most of the story for the real vampire to show up and eat him. So when we get to the end of the story and the townsfolk stake his ass, it's actually very satisfying.
It is.
Pete Williams shares this anecdote. Dave Vanian of the Damned caused a brief vampire scare in Wales. They were recording the Black album in a studio in Monmouth. Late one evening, he decided to take a break and went for a walk in the local graveyard, dressed in his usual Dracula clothes of the time. On his way back, as he was coming out of the graveyard, he was caught in the lights of a Mini driving along a lane. It made the local newspapers the next day as, "Woman sees ghost of a vampire." He kept quiet about it for 38 years. Grimly fiendish indeed.
Well, let's read some comments on Study 066, the Rocking Horse winner. Steve writes, indeed, Sherwood Forest is mostly not trees. That's because a forest, in the medieval sense, is an area set aside as a royal hunting ground. Even in the supposed time of Robin Hood, the wooded area was only 20 miles by 8 miles, and it contained many large open areas and was managed by its inhabitants.
Wow, so just a park, really, even in Robin Hood's time.
Yeah.
Merry men are playing frisbee. Little John forgot the drink boxes. Eric W. Mertz writes, great episode. Recently, I sold a house and realtors staged one of the rooms as a nursery. Mm-hmm. Of course, they added a rocking horse. It was the only toy included. I kept thinking about how everything they added was to achieve some desired effect, the rocking horse symbolic of youthful innocence.
There you go. Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, the love of money is the root of all evil. Paul's mother might have remembered. Would she also have remembered that the verse warns those who covet will have pierced themselves through with many sorrows. She cannot love her children, but she does love money. She lives beyond her means and wants her windfall and one lump sum to afford an even swankier lifestyle. And, inadvertently, to be fair, pushes her son to kill himself trying to win enough. I don't think that Paul's mother is evil, but she does end up piercing herself through with many sorrows. Paul might have focused his attention on Bassett and Uncle Oscar, who help him, are honest with him, but do not focus on maximizing their gain. But he didn't. Perhaps he couldn't. And he dies trying to fill an unfillable hole. I fear the story is less strange and more familiar and very, very sad.
Yeah, really sad. Mammals and humans are a successful group of animals because of familial love. We care for our offspring. And it goes both ways, but it also causes problems. Because if the parent is a lowlife or absent, a person will still do anything to get that love, no matter what a parent does to them or doesn't do, you know, even if they get abandoned. Speaking of love, we mentioned the love of D.H. Lawrence's life, Frieda von Richthofen, in that episode, whom I mentioned was a daughter of German nobility. Eric, Speaker in Digressions, writes, Frieda was a daughter of a Baron von Richthofen? So that made me do a Google. Whereupon I learned that while her dad was not Manfred, the Red Baron von Richthofen, I didn't even make the association.
Me neither.
A part of the reason the Lawrences were suspected of being German spies was that she was a distant cousin of the Flying Ace. A profile of Frieda on a Woman of Taos website also says that their neighbors in coastal Cornwall believed their hanging laundry contained coded messages to German U-boats.
God.
I can see how having that kind of neighbor would get tiresome.
Hastar hardly knew her, writes, this was possibly the best story we have heard in a long time. Just the story as itself, and a great episode along with it to boot. I gotta go read it. Like, tomorrow when I'm on vacation in Costa Rica, I'm gonna sit in the pool and read this story and possibly cry about children, society, and everything this story is discussing. Someone will ask me why I'm crying. I just wish the world didn't need boys riding rocking horses for their mothers. I don't know what's gonna happen after that statement. Should be interesting.
Is that a brag that he's going on vacation to Costa Rica? Or did he enjoy the story so much? He's like, the only way I can savor this is if I go on vacation.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is.
I think that's what it is. Lewis Davies writes, isn't the point of the story that the idea of luck is BS? The little boy's power is that he can see the future. Not that he has supernatural luck, but because his mother is obsessed with the concept of luck, that's how he interprets what he's doing. and it kills him as he desperately tries to reach the unachievable category of lucky person. One is also put in mind of the ancient Greek maxim of call no man fortunate until he is buried. Family's luck here is highly slippery. Up 80,000 pounds, but down a son. That's true. He could be riding that rocking horse to predict much more helpful things. Like where natural disasters are going to strike, when murders are going to be committed. Actually, I read in the original version of Minority Report, instead of those psychics floating around in the swimming pool, they had three boys riding rocking chairs. Predicting crimes. That was how it was when it was going to be a sequel to Total Recall, with Schwarzenegger coming back as Quaid.
Wow.
Which was true. That's what Minority Report was initially going to be.
Oh, really?
I'm not guilty. Get those boys off those rocking horses. That's true, though. It was going to be a sequel to Total Recall. Wish it had been. It's a good movie, but yeah. Schwarzenegger instead of Cruise?
Forget about it. Let's read some feedback on Feedback 17. Who put Bella in the witch elm?
Rafe Ball writes, your point about people including difficult words for you guys to read is a good one. Those posting their thoughts on episodes should be mindful of your appetency to avoid an ambuscade of Byzantine verbiage. We should all do our utmost to avoid such sesquipedalian tergiversation. And as for Christopher D. Singles and his Sisyphuses, Christopher should be anaspeptic, phrasmatic, even compunctuous to have caused you such paracombobulation. I could agree with that. I could see where Rafe's coming from.
Yeah. Kyle Griffiths writes, please keep putting the Dandolo effect in as often as you can.
I will, but you gotta wait. Put January 11th, 2024 on your calendar. Just write Dandolo.
Dandolo! Not to witch blame, but the Hagley Woods Bella in the Witch Elm is actually a lot more interesting and has a key Lovecraft connection. Some basics. As mentioned on the show, a young woman's skeleton was found by boys hunting for eggs during World War II, I believe 1943. There's quite a bit of detail on what she had on her person, as much of it was decaying but not gone. Clothes, shoes, a ring which is assumed to be a faux wedding ring due to its cost, etc. The graffiti is a key part of the story. It started popping up during the investigation, not later. Chalked or otherwise placed in various locations around the woods, which are south of Birmingham, if I remember correctly. Donald McCormick, a writer on mysteries and often not taken as a super reliable one, wrote Murder by Witchcraft in the 1960s. In this, he suggests that Bella was maybe a spy for reasons, but but as you may guess from the title, he also tied her to witchcraft. Why? Jeb goes on to a lot of detail here, and it's too much to put in the show, but it's super cool, and it makes some twists and turns, and it even ties in Margaret Murray of the witch cult in Western Europe fame, which was somebody that Lovecraft was interested in.
Yeah, it's a lot of good information about that puzzle. We posted just a picture of that graffiti on social media. People went crazy. So apparently it's something a lot of folks like to talk about.
Yeah.
People like the ending of The Living Dead, where the vampire wasn't real, sort of like a Scooby-Doo. On this feedback episode, we got this comment. Pierce Duncan writes, speaking of hoping to get an ending where the ghosts are real, did you chaps ever see Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island? And I admit I haven't seen that, but I know all about it. They did these straight-to-video movies in the late 90s of Scooby-Doo, and in those, the supernatural stuff was real.
Yeah, I heard about it, and I never saw them. Are they good?
I don't know if they're good, but I was talking to this dude that's 20 years younger than me. He was born in 94. And in so many respects, we were similar. He got an education degree, you know, was working in advertising for a while. We had all these things in common, except Scooby-Doo for me and Scooby-Doo for him were different. His was real supernatural. Mine was fake supernatural.
Wow.
It was like, because those were the movies he watched when he was a kid.
Yeah.
So there's a generation of folks born in the 90s. They think Scooby-Doo's fighting real monsters.
Yeah.
It's a weird world we live in. Since we're talking Scooby, let's get into other works of literature. With study number 67, Chekhov's The Bet. Jim Cannon writes, one thing the COVID period taught me was that it's not just time keeping me from finishing that novel. The PS4 and my lack of willpower shoulder much of the blame.
Ben A. writes, it is wonderful to hear you guys branching out into a broader assortment of stories of estrangement. Chekhov's work can take so much critical analysis and can be deeply applicable to modern life because he wrote about fundamental human nature. I remember reading The Bet in high school and feeling profoundly alienated at the end by the actions of both the banker and the lawyer. A couple of things occurred to me this time around. The banker is very bad at his job, and not just because he entered into this highly illogical arrangement. He had 15 years to generate $2 million. Could he have made investments at the beginning and know those funds would mature in time to see through his side of the bet? I know that's not the point, but it does speak to the fact that not only is the bet itself absurd, but the bettor is a thorough idiot. And I agree strongly with your sentiments at the end. The antidote to nihilism is engagement and life experience. Sure, nothing really matters in the end, but the reward of existence comes from shared experiences and the meaning we give them. Chekhov knew this, I think, and this tale illustrates why chronic isolationism can be the most damaging factor on psychology. I'm sure you all have seen the many recent headlines highlighting this, especially among middle-aged and older men.
I have, yeah. H.R. Price writes, "Me, yesterday. Man, I really got to get out and do stuff. The hermit habits I acquired during COVID are not doing my anxiety and depression any favors. Me, today. Do you have to look straight at me, Anton Chekhov?" Yeah.
Yeah. Carlandos writes, "Much to Chad's points about the internet, it's frightening how hollow, mentally and spiritually eroding it is to live vicariously through others, especially if you feel that you can't obtain or do any of the things you see and envy others for doing. It all seems to lead down the path of self-loathing to nihilistic disdain for everything." Yeah.
Eric Jordan Phillips writes, "As a younger person, I often felt that being alone, I did most of my best work, and I did get plenty done. For a period of 2 weeks before I left to go on a 2-year ecclesiastical excursion to Maine, that's a whole different story, I operated solo. The lesson I gleaned was life doesn't amount to much without another mind to magnify it and multiply your ideas. To quote a bit of scripture, it is not good for man to be alone." Richard Horseman writes, "Chekhov's gun is great when you're looking for economy in your storytelling. I like a bit of extraneous detail, though, like the amount of time you spend with the Polar Expedition guy in Frankenstein before the doctor or the monster shows up. Let's have a little pointless ornament and mood setting." Well, I agree, although that's kind of what I was trying to get at, that Chekhov's gun does not necessarily mean strip that stuff away or just have a plot, you know, a Hemingway-esque, you know, very slight sketch of a plot. I think Chekhov would say that the time that you spend with the Polar Expedition guy is crucial to that story because it sets up another person who has big dreams that, you know, Frankenstein could make an appeal to. Don't sacrifice your personal life and your family for these big dreams. Yeah. It's very important that you get to know those guys so that the theme comes through. So I don't know. I think it isn't pointless ornament, but I know what you're saying. Yeah. Now, there was a lot more discussion in the comments about capital punishment, Russian literature. As always, I do encourage folks to check them out and also our Discord. We can't read everything here, but there was a lot of great stuff on this episode.
Now let's dig into story 68, Harrison Bergeron and To Be or Not To Be. Patrick O. Whedon writes, "I didn't find Harrison as ridiculous as y'all did. The ballerina's brought to mind that Masked Singer show, and bringing people down to create equality is not an unheard of thought process today. Participation prizes only in competition, for instance. Also, I didn't hear you mention it in the review, but the man killed is his son that was taken from them, and they were unable to mourn his loss."
Yeah, when I was editing the episode, I realized we didn't explicitly state or discuss that Harrison was the couple's son.
Oh,
that
right.
They were missing at the beginning, and that they really couldn't deal with even watching him get killed on television. I guess we just thought it was obvious, but it just didn't come up, you know? So it was really funny when I go, I bet somebody's going to call us on that. Jason Thompson writes, "Yeah, I agree. I like Harrison Bergeron too. I think y'all were overthinking it a bit and think it works at face value with its sort of conservative idiocracy-ish pro-ableism message." That's a good comparison.
Yeah,
I don't think it's more ridiculous than a lot of science fiction dystopias. Although reading it for the first time since high school, I realized I'd forgotten the part where Harrison proclaims himself emperor. And also there's this uncomfortably Aryan description, which both could be evidence that it's meant as satire, or maybe Vonnegut was just trying to have it both ways. One of my English teachers once claimed that the entire point of Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5 was the opposite of what the narrator says, and it was all a high-level satire of fatalism. Is there a Vonnegut expert in the house who can tell us whether these stories are taking the piss or not? I hear what you're saying, but I think I can solve this. Nothing in art means just one thing, and stories can frequently express opposing viewpoints at the same time. I think the way that English is taught as a subject, there's variances in this, but it puts the cart a little before the horse with all the emphasis on symbolism that gets taught and theme. I know that the desire is to give students tools to have a deeper appreciation of reading, but I think fostering a love of reading is the more important part, and getting too far down the line with terms like that has the opposite effect, where people go, wait, red means hate? Or red means lust? Which one is it? I need to figure out the definition. Reading stresses me out because I don't know what the symbols mean, you know?
Right. Eric, speaker in digressions, writes, "Now, of course, I'm thinking of the scene in the Rodney Dangerfield movie, Back to School, where our wealthy protagonist has hired Kurt Vonnegut to write his essay on Kurt Vonnegut. But the professor gives him an F, saying whoever wrote it doesn't know anything about Kurt Vonnegut."
What a great joke.
I've got to tell you, that movie was my introduction to Kurt Vonnegut. When I saw my first Kurt Vonnegut book, Because that thing was on HBO, and I watched it over and over and over. When I was a kid, you know, whenever it came out, like, I must have been 13, 14. I loved that movie.
Yeah.
And I remember Kurt Vonnegut. And when I first, I think it was Breakfast of Champions or Slaughterhouse, but I don't remember which book it was in high school. Then I go, oh, wait, Kurt Vonnegut, he's the guy from Back to School.
That's awesome. You know what else? They shot Back to School here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh,
the
no,
Great
I didn't
Lakes
know that.
University where the kid goes is here. That's University of Wisconsin.
Oh, right.
And unfortunately, Rodney died in the building next door to where I worked. I worked at UCLA at the time. He was in the Ronald Reagan medical facility that was right next door to where my office was. And it was my birthday. October 5th, 2004, my 30th birthday, he died.
Oh, my God.
I felt terrible. I was like, he's right over there. When he was admitted to the hospital, the reporter asked him how long he'd be in there. And he said, if all goes well, about a week. If not, about an hour and a half. It was a good quip to end with. Anyhow, once again, there's a lot more discussion on the multiple interpretations of this story in the comments. Our listeners are smart, they're civil, they're sexy. Go check it out.
Absolutely. Let's look at their comments on Extra Credit 17, Wabi Sabi, and Weird Fiction. Rasmus Jewel writes, hey, so many thanks to you two for bringing this up and reminding me. It is so easy for me to always grind on myself for not doing enough and not doing good enough, especially during these long winter months. It's time to kick back and be a little bit more Wabi Shabby.
Wabi Shabby. I buy a lot of stuff from secondhand stores for around the house, and some people call that shabby chic, but I like to call it shabby passé. Nothing chic about this.
Ben A. writes, that was a very thoughtful and excellent discussion. I agree with you both that it is damaging to be precious about work. Too often I know people who chase that perfect at the cost of what one enjoys and what is good enough. As an academic, I constantly tell my graduate students that research papers, theses, and dissertations are abandoned, not finished. Mm-hmm. To go a step further, I'd argue that wabi-sabi is also at the heart of science as a creative endeavor. Scientific research only progresses because it is always an incomplete way of knowing the world, and every answer comes with many new questions. This is why I often get tired of the quest, for example, to have a unified theory of physics that unites relativity and quantum mechanics, as if having that theory will be the ultimate resolution. Any reconciliation between these ideas will only spur more questions. It's not that we shouldn't pursue that research or any other research because it never reaches a full resolution. That would be nihilism. But we should not do it because we believe that some perfect answer lies at the end of the road. This is a long way to write that there is never a perfect end. Like the fact you note, our lives are inherently incomplete and a brief part of a longer history / narrative. You guys said this perfectly at the end. Wabi Sabi, as a perspective, tells us that we should enjoy the now, to be present, to be inquisitive, and to recognize the imperfections and incompleteness, not as flaws, but as what makes the universe interesting. After all, much of Buddhism is about focusing on the moment and trying to shed oneself of desire.
That's great. I'm so happy that people enjoyed the episode. I wasn't sure if it was going to be relevant to everybody. Cubez writes, oh man, I didn't realize how much I needed this conversation. I work in a creative field and I've recently been developing some new products for my company to sell. I have been stressing out about every tiny detail in my prototypes. Not even an hour before I listened to this episode, I was complaining about how off-center some of my pieces were. My friends told me they couldn't see it, but I certainly can. Thanks for the reminder to slow down and reconsider what perfection means and what it doesn't mean. I always appreciate when you guys get philosophical.
Oh, well, thank you. That's awesome. Steve writes, my artistic medium is role-playing, in particular, writing and running games. There's a gaming idiom that no game survives an encounter with players, which purportedly speaks of the difficulty of writing scenarios. But for me, it's the joy. As someone running a game, I don't want to read the flavor text and have players do exactly what is expected of them. I want it to be challenging for the PCs and interesting for the players, and it's very rare and unlikely that the writer of the game has written it with your players in mind. Part of the thrill for me is responding and adapting to my players in that moment. As a GM, I want to be as creative as the players. I want to celebrate and use everyone's input, even if it goes against what is written.
That's great.
Yep.
I'm really happy with... I make a lot of jokes about improv groups on the show, but I'm really glad that I got the training I did in improv because it's all about writing that perfect script and then throwing it away once actors are doing it. You know, bring the creativity in and don't be precious with anything. And I think games are the same way. At least I'm learning that now because I'm working on one. Monster Talk writes... I just know I'm going to get confused and tell people loudly and drunkenly at some future party that Cabo Wabo is a somber Japanese design philosophy.
I had to look up Cabo Wabo was like this club in like Mexico that Sammy Hagar opened up in.
Yes, I knew that. I've watched too much. That. Like, you know, I watched Rock of Love, and I think they went to Cabo Wabo once. Or maybe they were at Senior Frogs. But for some reason, I know about the glam rock Mexican restaurants. A few people on this episode, like, it's a ghost. Specifically, Jeremy Impson noticed a mistake. Jeremy wrote, "Hey, was the overmix starting at 2409 an intentional introduction of an error? You sly dogs." Nope, that was a big mistake I made. I crossfaded a cut, and so it sounded weird.
Oh. But
it was an easy fix, so I just fixed it, re-rendered it, and re-uploaded it. So I guess this episode was more about how I'm full of that nothing is perfect. Because after I fixed it, you know what that was?
Perfect episode.
Just like this one. So let's bring it to an end before we screw anything up.
Folks, coming up on Thursday for your further holiday enjoyment, it's the Elves and Rumpelstiltskin.
Going to be a good episode. Tune in for that. Thanks for being with us and for making your comments. As always, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
The feedback episode.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.